England, though. Not to be overly personal or anything, sir. The clerk's cheeks reddened as he realized he'd overstepped his bounds with a gentleman.
Not at all, said Holmes with a smile. One needs a pistol here to keep up on the target shooting with one's American friends, what?
Of course, sir.
The absence of a hammer feels strange, said Holmes. Does the weapon jam or misfire very often?
No, sir. Not the Smith & Wesson brand. As reliable a double action as they make. Looks strange, I agree, but it's the best weapon you can carry concealed when you don't have large pockets. And even then, hammers and the large sights can snag on cloth and pockets and such, can't they?
Indeed, said Holmes. How much for this pistol?
$5, sir.
That seems a bit steep.
I throw in 2 boxes of cartridges with the lemon squeezer, sir.
Done, said Holmes.
Shall I box it and wrap it up, sir?
No, Holmes had said. I'll carry it on me.
And Holmes was carrying the seemingly hammerless S&W, loaded, save for 1 empty chamber, in 1 oversized outer pocket of his tweed suit, and the 2 boxes of cartridges in the opposite oversized pocket, a short time later when he called on John Hay. The former diplomat was just sitting down to breakfast when Holmes was shown in, and the detective assured him that his visit wouldn't take more than 2 minutes, and he'd be happy to have some coffee while Hay ate. As succinctly as possible, and never mentioning the previous night's adventure in Rock Creek Cemetery, or the ominous figure smoking his cigarettes in the dark, Holmes explained that he was moving out of Mrs. Stevens's boarding house, a necessity, alas, and that he was concerned for Mr. James's safety.
Certainly James has no enemies in Washington, cried Hayes. I would doubt that Mr. James has enemies anywhere, said Holmes, but I have enemies, and it has come to my attention that they may know of my presence in Washington, even my current address at Mrs. Stevens' establishment.
Hay looked concerned and dabbed a linen napkin at his sharp beard and perfectly trimmed mustache.
But certainly they wouldn't. An innocent such as Harry. It is a long shot, as you Americans say, said Holmes. A remote possibility. But these particular people are beyond all laws of reason and decency. I would not sleep well imagining them showing up at Mrs. Stevens' home and coming across Mr. James.
Hay looked sharply at the detective.
Would my family be in danger if Harry stayed here? Not in the least. How can you be so sure, sir?
Hay's pleasant demeanor had disappeared for a moment into the sharp cross-examining tones of a prosecutor.
These people may not recognize the extent of Henry James's literary fame, said Holmes, but I am certain that they know your reputation, Mr. Hay, and would do nothing associated with you or your family or your guest that would bring publicity down on their heads. Then I'll ask Harry to drop by today and insist, I tell you, that he stay with us again, said Hay.
Holmes loved the tone of a man who could make up his mind in a few seconds.
Could you ask him to drop by at about 5:15, said Holmes. Yes, if you wish.
Hay squinted slightly at the detective.
Is there a special reason for that time? Just that I don't wish to bump into Mr. James once I've moved out of Mrs. Stevens' pleasant home, and I may be in this area earlier in the day. I shall specify 5:15, said Hay, and started to rise as Holmes stood. No, please don't get up, and thank you for this favor, said Holmes. If I need to get in touch with you, began Hay.
Holmes handed him one of his cards with the cigar store address handwritten on the back.
This establishment is open around the clock for some inexplicable reason, he said, and they promise to get any message to me as quickly as they can.
Holmes and Hay had shaken hands, and then the detective hurried down the street to catch Henry James before he had his breakfast brought to his room. 10. A Small Bouquet of White Violets. Holmes knocked on Henry Adams's front door at 5 p.m., precisely the time he'd suggested in his early morning note, and to which Adams had agreed in his return note that morning. The door was opened at once, and Holmes was confronted with the dour face of an elderly butler. He now knew all of the Hayes family servants by face and name, but he hadn't been formally introduced to Henry Adams's home or staff. The butler said nothing, closed the door behind the detective, nodded his head to indicate that Holmes should follow, and led him directly up a staircase Holmes had seen only in the darkness of his burgling night. At the upstairs study, the grim-faced butler waited only for Adams to nod from his place behind a full but not cluttered desk before he closed the door behind Holmes. There had been no announcement, no greeting, not even a "please follow me, sir," from the side-whiskered old retainer, but perhaps Adams had directed his man not to speak to Holmes. At any rate, Holmes did not feel slighted. He looked around the book-lined study with some interest. It was a scholar's study, and illuminated not only by desk and table lamps, but by large windows, some leaded with ornate stained glass, others clear. Through the clear windows, Holmes looked directly across the street at the president's executive mansion. Adams neither rose nor spoke, so Holmes took the initiative of walking across the room to the desk, setting his top hat, gloves, and walking stick on one chair, and sitting on the other one that was opposite Adams across the desk.
"You have put me in an impossible position, Mr. Sherlock Holmes," the bald scholar said softly,
but not so softly that Holmes missed the substrate of anger and frustration in Adams's tone. Rather than disagree or comment in any way, Holmes merely nodded.
"I made my mystery far too simple, didn't I?" said Adams. "Too many clues."
"Actually, just enough clues," said Holmes, "and not all of them deliberate."
"Your note this morning said only that you had solved the mystery and looked out at the world from a mourner's eyes. I presume that means you
went in the monument," finished Holmes.
"Yes."
Henry Adams looked down at the papers on his desk, and for a moment the man's face, even the flesh of his mostly bare scalp, went so terribly pale that Holmes was concerned that the older man was having a heart attack or stroke. But then Adams looked up, sat up straighter.
"Well, then,"
Adams said in an only slightly shaky voice,
"you know the greatest secret in my life, Mr. Holmes. I was foolish enough and overconfident enough to give a man like you far too simple clues to the secret. And now you know."
Adams's body twitched suddenly as if he'd been jolted by an electric current.
"You didn't tell James, did you?" "I've spoken neither to Henry James nor to anyone else about this matter last night or this morning," said Holmes,
feeling the lawyerly dodge of his words almost stick in his craw. Adams nodded.
"For that I can be thankful."
The scholar sighed and folded his hands on his desk.
"And now what, Mr. Holmes? Do we discuss the concept of money changing hands?"
Holmes could have acted outraged, was tempted to do so, but did not.
"I accept fees for my services as an investigator, Mr. Adams," he said coolly, "not payment as a blackmailer."
Adams's expression still had not changed.
"Then what are your fees as an investigator, in this instance, Mr. Holmes?"
$1, said Holmes, "and already paid 2 years ago by your wife's late brother, Edward."
"Ned,"
said Adams with a strange, almost pained tone to his voice. Holmes nodded again. Suddenly Adams seemed to shake himself out of a haze.
"I apologize,"
he said, half rising and reaching for a velvet pull rope on the wall.
"I haven't asked you if you would like a cup of tea or coffee or a glass of whiskey."
"Nothing, thank you."
Adams almost collapsed back into his chair.
"You are,"
he said very softly,
"probably the only man alive who knows what a monster I am."
Mourner, said Holmes. Not monster. Never monster. A mourner of someone truly loved, who has found a unique way to see others mourning his lost love. Adams almost laughed.
If you heard some of the comments, saw some of their clowning at first encountering St. Gaudens' sculpture, heard them guessing at the price of the monument, or criticizing its solemnity, or its lack of religious purpose, or its lack of joy in the hope and sure certainty of eternal redemption. We are a strange and inexplicable species, Mr. Holmes.
Indeed. What do you want, sir? Asked Henry Adams. I want, need, to discover the truth of your wife Clover's death more than 7 years ago, said Holmes.
She drank potassium cyanide and died almost instantaneously, Adams said briskly. There is really nothing else to discuss, much less uncover.
Holmes sighed and leaned forward so that his hands were also folded on Adams's broad desk.
I apologize for my bluntness, Mr. Adams, and there will be more such bluntness before we are finished. But it is not out of cruelty I make these comments or ask these questions, but out of a need for clarity.
Adams had sat further back in his chair, but met Holmes's sharp, gray gaze with a steady one of his own.
Mrs. Adams's death would have hardly been near instantaneous, Holmes said in soft but solid tones. I have published monographs on more than 300 poisonous substances and combinations of such, their symptoms, their lethality rated on a scale of 100, their odor, their efficacy. Potassium cyanide, in any dose large enough to kill Mrs. Adams, would have burned her tongue and throat. Then this particular poison cuts off the body's ability to process oxygen, in essence asphyxiating the victim. But Mrs. Adams would have choked and gasped for air, perhaps ripping off her collar or bodice in an attempt to breathe. For some terrible moments, she would have thrashed about and fallen to the floor, where the poison would have assured more minutes of violent convulsions. Then,
enough!
Cried Henry Adams, slapping his palm so violently against the top of his desk that the noise sounded like a rifle shot in the room. Almost instantly, the door was flung open, and the aged head butler half entered.
Sir, are you all right? I heard...
Adams was still looking down, but nodded, and said through a thick voice,
Quite all right, Hobson. You needn't wait outside any longer. Yes, sir.
The door was closed silently, and Holmes could hear what he'd noticed the lack of earlier, the butler's footsteps receding down the hall and then down the staircase. Holmes returned his attention to Adams and felt the intensity of the older man's gaze. If looks were knives, this one would have decapitated and gutted Holmes.
Why do you tell me these things?
Rasped Adams. Holmes pointed to one of the hundreds of leather-bound volumes on the wall of books behind Adams.
Sedford's Poisons and Their Effects, 9th edition.
You know all these details, Mr. Adams. You have researched this poison as carefully as you've researched Thomas Jefferson's administrations. You wanted the truth, no matter how hard it was to bear. So do I. Yes. All right.
The scholar took a deep breath.
The parlor where I found Clover's body looked as if three sailors had been fighting in it. Drapes torn, tables overturned, lamps smashed, pillows slashed by her nails, crystal objects flung down from the mantel. And Clover's face, it was monstrous in its frozen terror and distortion, Mr. Holmes.
Holmes nodded. After allowing a moment of silence, he said,
You lied to the police and newspapers, Mr. Adams.
Adams's head and shoulders snapped backwards. Dim afternoon sunlight glinted on his bald head and clenched fists. For a second or two, while studying Adams's expression, Holmes was reminded of the key demon masks he'd seen in a no play in Kyoto. But Adams said nothing. Holmes watched the scholar's clenched right hand drop just above the drawer there and wondered if Henry Adams kept a pistol in that drawer. Holmes's new lemon squeezer, loaded, was in the right front pocket of his tweed jacket.
You told the police and the papers that you had left your wife alone that Sunday morning because you had to visit your dentist, said Holmes. That wasn't true.
Adams's small body actually rocked to and fro slightly as if in response to his mental struggle. Finally, he said,
No, that wasn't true. Why did you leave that morning, Mr. Adams? Clover and I had quarreled. Violently.
And then, as if realizing the legal import of that word, he said quickly,
For Clover and me, it was violently, although voices were barely raised. We weren't a couple who shouts, ever. But you argued.
Yes.
Over what? Said Holmes. Clover had been distraught, close to despair. And that morning she was in tears, almost hysterics, because Sunday at that hour had always been the time she wrote to her father. Her father, who was now dead.
You argued about her emotions, or about her writing a letter? Said Holmes.
I insisted she begin a new Sunday routine, said Adams. Write a letter to her sister Ellen. Make Sundays a day for something other than melancholy and mourning after those many months.
She did write that letter, or a fragment of it, to her sister after you left, said Holmes.
She told her sister that, and I believe I quote, Henry has been more patient and loving than words can express. And, in the final uncompleted paragraph, Henry has been and is, beyond all words, tenderer and better than all of you, even.
Why do you think she would write such a note just after the two of you had quarreled and you'd stalked out, Mr. Adams?
Adams looked like a writer forced to watch his entire life's work burned page by page in a fire.
I don't know, Mr. Holmes. No more than I know how you got the precise wording of Clover's letter to Ellen.
The police made a copy,
Holmes said, making a gesture with his bare right hand as if batting away something trivial or not worth discussing. He cleared his throat.
It sounds as if, continued Holmes, Mrs. Adams was writing a form of suicide note to her sister, making sure that you were not in any way to blame.
Adams only shook his head, whether in negation or confusion, Holmes couldn't tell.
Earlier in the letter to her sister, said Holmes, Mrs. Adams wrote, and again I believe I can cite it fully from memory, If I had one single point of character or goodness, I would stand on that and grow back to life. But then the letter ends. Why did you turn around and go home so quickly, Mr. Adams, after only 10 minutes or so of walking? I know you had no appointment with your dentist that morning.
Adams lifted a fountain pen from the tabletop and held it in both hands as if he were going to snap it.
I became alarmed, he said at last, concerned. I realized that it had been a bastardly thing to do, leaving Clover alone in the house on a morning when she was hurting so much. And upon returning to your home, then, at 1607 H Street, just down the street, said Holmes, you told the police that you found Miss Rebecca Lorne waiting outside the front door. You said that she asked your opinion on whether she should go up and visit Clover that day.
Adams said nothing. His usually almost frighteningly intelligent eyes seemed to have a haze over them.
A translucent call of memory, thought Holmes.
Why did you lie about that as well, Mr. Adams? Said Holmes.
Adams blinked.
Who said that I lied? I did. You encountered Rebecca Lorne coming out the front door of your house on 8th Street. She was weeping, as hysterical as Mrs. Adams had been a short time earlier. She had trouble telling you what she had found when she went up to visit Mrs. Adams, didn't she, Mr. Adams?
Yes, I had to take her into the foyer,
so that no one could hear her hysterics. It took me a full minute or two to get her calmed down to the point where Miss Lorne could tell me what she'd discovered upstairs.
How did she get in? Asked Holmes, leaning forward again.
What? I'm sure you locked the door behind you when you left to work off your anger in your walk, said Holmes. How did Rebecca Lorne gain entry to your home?
Oh, Clover had had an extra key made up for Rebecca a month or two earlier, Adams answered almost distractedly. We'd hoped to go to New York for some shopping. A vain hope, as it turned out. And Clover had given Miss Lorne the key, so that she could drop in to check on the servants and see that the plants were properly watered.
Rebecca Lorne discovered Mrs. Adams's body in the wreckage that had been the parlor. Not you, said Holmes.
He did not phrase it as a question, and Adams did not answer other than to nod ever so slightly. Eventually, Adams spoke in hollowed-out tones, the voice of a man who has passed through hell and who knows he must go there again.
In those last months, it was only Rebecca Lorne who seemed to give Clover any surcease of her sorrow over her father's death. Clover had stopped seeing most of her usual friends. It's not quite fair to say that she and Miss Lorne were inseparable during those last late summer and autumn months. But there's no one whom Clover looked forward to seeing more than Miss Lorne.
Hadn't the two of them paid a call on Mrs. Cameron? Lizzie Cameron, the previous evening? Asked Holmes.
Adams blinked rapidly once again.
Yes, they had. Lizzie had been very ill with the influenza, I believe. Clover visited her and Miss Lorne accompanied her. They brought flowers and a book.
Holmes removed the untitled publicity photograph of Irene Adler from his upper jacket pocket and handed it across to Henry Adams.
Is this a picture of Rebecca Lorne?
Adams moved the photograph back and forth to bring it into proper focus.
Well, yes, it appears to be Miss Lorne. Her dress here is more showy, is perhaps the right word, and she looks a little younger than when I last saw her, but this appears to be Rebecca.
Holmes took the photo back.
This is a program advertisement for a certain Irene Adler, American-born but European-trained.
Trained in what? Said Adams.
Opera, acting on the stage, and blackmail, said Holmes. Most specially that last skill.
I don't believe it.
You remember her cousin, a certain Clifton Richards?
Of course, said Adams. He worked in the photographic section of the State Department.
Adams paused, and the haze came over his eyes again.
He's the one who brought Clover the new developing solution that contained the potassium cyanide.
His real name is Lucan, said Holmes.
Possibly Lucan Adler. Probably Irene Adler's son.
Adams shook his head again.
You didn't see or talk to Lucan, this cousin Clifton, on the day you met Rebecca Lorne coming out of your house. The day Clover died?
No.
So he might have been in the house and exited via the back stairs when you ran up the front stairs, and he may have slipped out the back way into the alley, said Holmes.
An extraordinary and outrageous supposition, said Henry Adams. We have no evidence that her cousin Clifton was with her in my home on that terrible day.
No, said Holmes, but we know beyond a doubt that Clifton Richards was Adler the assassin. And without questioning Irene Adler, your so-called Rebecca Lorne, we simply cannot know the truth of that day. And there was an obituary for Irene Adler in the March 1886 London Times.
Adams shook his head again, but with a negative hand gesture this time, a physical pushing away of Holmes's words or their import.
No, this Irene Adler cannot have been the same woman that I knew so well in the year before Clover's death. I've written letters to Miss Lorne. It's been Mrs. Braxton of Boston over the years, and she has always responded. Recently, said Holmes, his ears metaphorically perking up like a hunting hound's. Her last letter to me was last autumn, I believe, said Adams. So you see that your late actress person cannot be Mrs. Rebecca Lorne Braxton of Boston. And her handwriting has stayed the same, said Holmes. Yes, of course, said Adams. But I shall show you the letters. You may make your own judgment. Mrs. Braxton has never sent me a typewritten missive such as those accursed annual cards you are so clumsily and invasively investigating. When was Miss Lorne married? About 2 years after my wife's death, said Adams. Miss Lorne had moved to Boston in January of 1886, only a month after. She sent me a note of her marriage in August of 1888. I know only that her husband is somewhat older than she, and that he makes a living in the sea trade with India. May I see these letters? Hers to you, I mean, not yours to her.
Holmes expected an argument, possibly harsh words, but Adams must have been expecting the request. He pulled a small bundle of envelopes, tied in a pink bow, from the main drawer of his desk.
Read them, Mr. Holmes. Take them with you, as long as you promise to return them. You shall find nothing in Rebecca Lorne Braxton's letters to me, or in my short notes to her, for that matter, should the lady allow you to read them some day, but normal conversation between an aging widower and his wife's friend. A friend, like the husband, still deep in mourning after 7 years.
Adams's tone was flat, almost businesslike. Holmes accepted the bundle of letters in silence.
Another thing. Another mystery, if you will, Mr. Holmes, said Adams.
Holmes held the letters in his lap and waited.
Every year on December 6, said Adams, the anniversary of Clover's death, I have found, or Hay and my other friends have found when I was traveling in the South Seas, a small bouquet of white violets, Clover's favorite flower, set on my wife's grave in Rock Creek Cemetery. I am certain that they have been set there every December 6 by Rebecca Lorne.
How can you know this? Asked Holmes. Did she admit to this?
No. I have never mentioned it to her in our occasional correspondence, said Adams. I simply know. I have not written to thank her yet, but some day I shall.
But you said that Miss Lorne, Mrs. Braxton now, has lived in Boston these 7 years.
Yes.
Mr. Adams, you really believe that Rebecca Lorne Braxton makes the long trip to Washington every December 6th, never to contact you, but only to leave this bouquet of white violets on your wife's grave?
I do, Mr. Holmes. She has never spoken of it in her letters, but I am certain that particular act of kindness is hers. It matches the personality of the woman I knew in 1885. Rebecca Lorne was and is a kind person, Mr. Holmes. She was my wife's friend. To even think that she was in any way involved with, or, God forbid, responsible for my wife's death, Clover's death by melancholy, as I often think of it, is more than a grave error in judgment, Mr. Holmes. It is investigative malpractice. And it is also a callous act of slander.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Adams, said Holmes,
standing and retrieving his hat, gloves, and stick. Adams remained seated.
Are you leaving Washington soon? Asked the scholar.
I will be doing some traveling in relation to this investigation and another, but I can be reached through that cigar store address at any time, said Holmes.
I will have no more to say on this matter, said Adams. I would appreciate you returning the letters before you begin your travels. You may give them to Hobson when the time comes. There is no further reason for us to meet or speak.
Holmes nodded.
I'll find my own way out, Mr. Adams. I thank you for your time and cooperation.
He patted the small bundle of letters in his chest pocket. But Henry Adams had returned his gaze to the papers on his desk and did not look up. Holmes paused in the open doorway, sensing but not seeing Hobson hovering somewhere out of sight down the hallway.
One last question, Mr. Adams.
Adams raised his head. There was no sigh, frown, or rolling of the eyes, and, once again, Holmes admired the historian's self-discipline.
Your windows there, the clear ones, said Holmes, offer an astonishingly good view of the president's house, especially of that one set of windows.
Adams said nothing. He did not turn his head to look at the windows Holmes was pointing toward, nor did he have to. Adams had worked in this study and had that view since 1886.
Do you happen to know, Mr. Adams, which room in the White House those windows serve, and, as odd as my query sounds, whether President Cleveland often frequents that room? I can only tell you that when Mrs. Adams and I visited the president's house during his first term, that room was the office and receiving room for the president's sister, Miss Rose Elizabeth Cleveland, who served as the de facto first lady of the land until 1886, when Mr. Cleveland entered into marriage. I believe that ceremony was the only marriage service ever held on the grounds for a chief executive in the history of the White House. When Mr. Cleveland returned to office and resumed his occupancy there only last month, it is my understanding that his sister did not return to Washington with him. I believe she has become the administrator of some little collegiate institution in Indiana, Lafayette, Indiana, to be precise. She has published often on what they now call feminist issues, that is, women's rights. I've read that she took part in the first International Women's Conference in Paris last year. So, no. I have no idea what the room behind those windows is used for at the present time, only that the president's sister will not be there.
Holmes smiled at the historian's completeness, if not civil tone, in answering such a silly question, nodded his thanks, and closed the door behind him. As he hurried to the waiting hansom before Henry James, visiting next door, might glimpse him, Holmes knew that the interview had given up at least one possibly relevant fact. Henry Adams's study was the perfect location for a Lucan Adler-type assassin with a rifle. 11. The Wheel of Time. For the first day or two after Henry James returned to the Hayes home as an artist whose privacy had to be respected at all times, the writer was relieved and as happy as he'd been since before the turn of the year. His guest suite at the far end of what Americans called the second story was large, comfortable, and private. If James chose to join John and Clara Hay for a meal, his hosts were delighted to have him. If he preferred absolute privacy, which he did for those first days, the servant assigned to him, Gregory, would bring up a menu before each meal, and James would choose his own breakfast, lunch, or dinner, with no reference to what his hosts were having. In those first few days, James celebrated Holmes's complete absence, much in the way he'd quietly celebrated the disappearance of the worst pains of gout that had so hobbled him around Christmas and the New Year in London. There were no more cigarettes stubbed into egg yolks, no more inane conversations about conspiracies and assassinations, no more late-night outings to cemeteries or creeping into memorial sculptures with secret passages. James felt liberated. He was free now, with Holmes gone, free to rest or write or just walk and think, or to book passage on the next steamship to England if he so wished. Things could not have turned out better. Then why, he wondered on April 7th, the Friday of that first week at the Hayes, did he feel as deeply listless and actively melancholy as he had in March, when he decided to go to Paris to drown himself in the Seine? Lying in bed that night, the literary contents of his portmanteau poured out onto the blanket beside him, James looked through his notebooks. His markets for short stories seemed to have dried up, and publishers in both England and America had mostly moved away from the long, serialized tale that had, in the spirit of Dickens, kept James busy writing for so many years. His last two novels, The Reverberator and The Tragic Muse, the latter released 3 years ago in 1890, had sold poorly, as did his story collection published in that same year, The Aspern Papers. He had three books scheduled to be published later this year, Picture and Text in June, his essays on art, Essays in London, to appear later in the summer, essentially a compilation of his tributes to his many friends who had died recently. Finally, his collection of stories, The Private Life, and other tales. But none of these were major novels, and his essays and short story collections had never brought in much money or notice. It was clear that the literary world had passed Henry James by. Or, perhaps, he mused, he had somehow wandered away from it. Thus his resolution last year, the resolution that had come before his resolution to kill himself, to begin a new and far more financially and in its way socially rewarding career of writing for the theater. His first play, The American, adapted rather loosely from his novel by the same name, so loosely that he'd first titled the play The Californian, had a run of 70 nights in London and more weeks before and after in the provinces. James had enjoyed the process, reading the four-act play to the actors as a French author-director would, watching them rehearsing it, bringing them chicken and soups and other nourishing lunches during their long rehearsal days, encouraging them, bantering with them, participating, being accepted, laughing with others and making them laugh with his droll wit, some of it in new lines written for the play as it evolved and changed. How different all that had been from his decades of disciplined isolation while writing his scores of stories and overflowing shelf of novels. But all that labor, to what purpose? He made enough money to rent the lovely, light-filled apartments at 364 De Vere Gardens, his home since 1886. But even there, he was restless. He'd deliberately given up most of the evening and weekend London social life he'd enjoyed so much in the past years in order to spend more time writing. Dedicate oneself to one's work was his new mantra, and to do that one had to stop accepting dinner invitations 5 nights of the week, endless invitations to join the rich bourgeoisie whom he was invited to amuse at their country houses and Irish estates with his ample supply of small talk, wit, and gossip. But while he had loved working in isolation, his work was no longer earning him what it should, either in dollars and pounds or in fame. Oh, not that he'd ever striven after riches or fame. No, the art had always come first. Always. But he had long imagined that before age 50, his work would have allowed him financial freedom enough to what? Perhaps to buy himself an English country house by the sea. Just a cottage, of course, a tidy little seasonal home in addition to his flat at De Vere Gardens. A cozy country place at which he would host literary friends and his brother William and his family when they came to England. A place where he could host his younger male friends, Paul Bourget, say, or Edmund Gosse, with privacy. In the end, after all his work, the theatrical group had totally rewritten James's gloomy, their word, third act, to turn The American into a not very successful comedy. Although the Prince of Wales had come to see The American in London, and that had prompted the producer to attempt a second opening of the shortened and rewritten play at its 50th performance, James once again helping to fill the expensive seats and boxes with the author's literary and high society friends, audiences remained lackluster until James finally had to agree with the critics. The play into which he and his sister Alice had poured so much of their optimism had been a failure on many levels. He'd frantically abandoned his literary roots, he knew, to achieve a well-made play, and that eager pandering had turned his serious novel into an absurdly paced melodrama on stage. The highly literate drama critic A.B. Walkley had written of the non-stop busyness of his script. "What, Mr. James? All this between dinner and the suburban trains? James was sure it had also been Walkley in an anonymous review who'd said that James had offered the public little other than a stage American with a local color laid on with a trowel, a strong accent, a fearful and wonderful coat, and a recurrent catchword. Edward Compton, the producer and lead actor, indeed had mastered the American dialect to a fault. In his later viewings of his play, James clearly heard the caricature of American English he'd penned and the catchword phrase James had given him, after Compton told him that such catchwords were important for characters on stage, had been, "That's what I want to see," which by James' last viewing of the crippled, hobbled, emasculated play seemed to be every third line for Compton's American character. As for the giant chocolate-colored coat, Compton had coveted the garment during rehearsals and provincial openings.
"Gives the audience a sense of this American's real nature," the actor-producer had said after the first out-of-London auditions.
But, James could see now, it had been an absurd wardrobe choice. One critic wondered in print if all Americans skinned buffaloes to wear their entire hairy hide as a coat. Another compared Compton's giant brown buttons to chocolate-covered cupcakes. The best thing written by critics about his American leading lady, Miss Elizabeth Robbins, was that her acting was a tad less somnambulistic in some of the later stagings. In the earlier performances, critics had called her acting, essentially of an inert woman, a listener, an observer, as bordering on the hysterical, if not the outright deranged. The poor actress James had seen had been totally miscast in his role for a basically passive and passionless woman, had tried the full spectrum from deranged to hysterical, then as somnambulistic as if she'd been drugged with laudanum, and now back to the tad less somnambulistic. After her recent successes in playing Hedda and Nora in Ibsen's strangely popular plays, this critical pillorying of her Claire character in The American made her weep after every performance. James had felt like weeping with her. An anonymous critic for The Era had summed up Henry James's first theatrical contribution thusly: "We are as anxious as the critics of the newest school to hail the advent on our stage of literary men, but it is on condition that they bring their literature with them." This, the truth of this statement, had hurt James more than he would ever admit. He remembered writing to Henrietta Rubel in 1890, in the early days of his long struggle with The American, "I have written a big and awfully good four-act play by which I hope to make my fortune." Well, it had been big, but in the end, James had to admit that it had not been awfully good. In many ways, it had been merely awful. He remembered writing to his friend Robert Louis Stevenson, now on a distant island in the South Pacific, "My zeal in the affair is only matched by my indifference," but in the same letter enthusing, "I find the form opens out before me as if it were a kingdom to conquer." Yet by the end of the same contradictory letter, he was telling Stevenson, "A kingdom, yes, but my standards, by our standards, my absent and never distant friend, a paltry kingdom of ignorant brutes for managers and dense cabotins of actors." And more recently, when he was down with gout before deciding to go to Paris, he'd written to Stevenson, "Don't be hard on me. Simplifying and chastening necessity has laid its brutal hand on me, and I have had to try to make, somehow or other, the money I don't make by literature. My books don't sell, and it looks as if my plays might. Therefore, I am going with a brazen front to write half a dozen." On this Friday evening in April of 1893, only a week and day from his 50th birthday, James realized that he never had come to grips with what writing for the theater really entailed. Yet in his portmanteau here at the Hayes home, he had carried with him to America three completed stage comedies, a drama written specifically for one actress who had aged beyond the role he'd created solely for her, extensive notes on five other possible plays, and the first three sketched-in acts of a serious drama he thought he might call Guy Domville. In one of his earlier notes was a list of possible names for the eponymous character in this play, about the lone scion of a wealthy family being called back from a monastery to choose between holy orders and continuing his family's name through marriage and children. James also had the original notes he'd made years earlier in Venice after hearing an anecdote about the apprentice monk who had been forced to renounce either his family's continuance or his holy vows. At the time, he'd thought it might develop into a short story and had given it the tentative title, The Hero. Situation of that once-upon-a-time member of an old Venetian family, I forget which, who had become a monk and who was taken almost forcibly out of his convent and brought back into the world in order to keep the family from becoming extinct. It was absolutely necessary for him to marry. James had long ago abandoned The Hero as the title of the play version of this tale, had added several extra dramatic, perhaps melodramatic, layers to the basic decision the hero had to make, and decided that amongst all these possible names for his hero, names filling two full pages in one of the thin notebooks he'd brought with him, he had liked Domville the best. It had taken him longer to come up with the eponymous leading character's first name. At one time, he'd toyed with Boy, just because he liked the sound of it. But for the last few months, it had solidified into Guy. Guy Domville. Obviously, this was no longer a play set in Venice. But would the male and very masculine protagonist's heroic act consist of consenting to a loveless marriage? A marriage into which a villain with the villainous name of Devinish was trying to ensnare Guy Domville? Or would his character resist this temptation and renounce life, love, family, and any future for his noble family's name by returning to holy orders and cold celibacy? Lying there in John Hay's guest room in the near darkness, the small pool of light from his bedside lamp illuminating only his pale hands and the small pile of his notebooks, James imagined that the double renunciation at the end of the play would bring tears to sensitive souls in the audience. He could imagine his elaborately dressed actor saying loudly, "I'm the last, my lord, of the Domvilles." Everyone in the theater would either weep or be struck into awed silence. But would they? James felt like weeping. He wished Sherlock Holmes would return. On the next day, Saturday morning, precisely 1 week before his dreaded birthday, having just finished breakfast, Gregory had whisked the tray away with his usual silent efficiency when James had rung the little bell, and dressed in his finely tailored brown pinstripe suit and waistcoat, Henry James sat in the spring sunlight at the table near the open window of his wonderful guest suite and wrote the following. Among the delays, the disappointments, the déboires of the horrid theatric trade, nothing is so soothing as to remember that literature sits patient at my door, and that I only have to lift the latch to let in the exquisite little form that is, after all, nearest to my heart, and with which I am so far from having done. I let it in. The old brave hours come back. I live them over again. I add another little block to the small literary monument that it has been given to me to erect. James paused and looked at what he had just written. It was hogwash, sentimental hogwash. He had committed himself to making his fortune writing for the theater, and there was no little latch he could lift that would let his cozy and financially unrewarding literary efforts come tiptoeing back in. And what was this self-serving babble about building a small literary monument for himself, block by block? Flaubert had answered that conceit rather concisely with his comment. Books are made not like children, but like pyramids, and they're just as useless. And they stay in the desert. Jackals piss at their foot, and the bourgeois climb up on them. Henry James would soon turn 50, and while he'd sown his literary wild oats with both abandon and determined discipline, at this dark moment he doubted very much if any of his literary children would outlive him, at least by not much more than a few years at best. Even his attempts to get his peers, or at least his younger literature-oriented male friends, to call him Master, Maître, had failed. If they did so, at his actual urgings, they made it into something like a joke. No, there was no literary monument out there for him, or of him. No monument built block by his patient workmanship. And for the temporary monuments he'd labored so hard to construct, the critic jackals were indeed pissing on them, the tiresome bourgeois, especially in America, clambering over his blocks and scratching their initials in his oh-so-carefully cut stones with nails and knives. Just last year, he'd written a story he'd very much liked titled The Wheel of Time. In it, his main character, yet another reflection of himself as seen through a glass darkly, thinks much about his distant youth while musing on his 49th birthday. About youth, he regretted it. He missed it. He tried to beckon it back. But the differences in London made him feel that it had gone forever. There might perhaps be some compensation in being 50, some turn of the dim telescope, some view from the brow of the hill. It was a round, gross, stupid number, which probably would make one pompous, make one think oneself venerable. Meanwhile, at any rate, it was odious to be 49. But with that round, odious number of 50 now bearing down on him like a freight train in the night, just as impervious, just as terrifying, just as unavoidable, he would pay anything to remain 49 forever, or if that was not possible, at least for another few unpassing years. James realized to his horror that he was close to tears. Maybe that young pink American pig named Teddy Roosevelt had been right. Perhaps he was effeminate in his thoughts and writings. James was aching to write someone a letter, but he couldn't, shouldn't. This trip to America was to remain a secret from his friends and epistolary interlocutors. More hogwash. He was a man of letters in more than the literary sense. Henry James wrote a letter to someone, usually multiple letters to multiple someones every day of his life. In a real sense, writing and receiving letters was the way he kept in touch with life. At the moment, he felt an overwhelming need to write a letter to Constance Fenimore Woolson about what had happened to him over the past few weeks. He knew that Fenimore had turned 53 last month in March. He'd written her a clever letter offering his elliptical birthday wishes, so she might understand his feelings about turning 50. To his recollection, they'd never discussed the topic of aging. Fenimore, an American writer like James, in self-exile in Europe for decades, was the focus of the closest thing to a romantic relationship with a woman that James had ever felt or allowed. Of course, he really had no romantic notions about Fenimore, certainly no sensual or sexual ones. The thought of an unclad woman's body appealed to him only in a very few classical paintings and sculptures. It was the nude male form that moved James in some deep, solid, but uncertain way. Ever since that day he walked into his brother William's Newport Art Group's life drawing class and saw their cousin Gus standing there naked as the model. But at one point, for weeks when both of them were staying in Fenimore's rented chalet of Bello Sguardo, high above Venice, Fenimore in her rooms upstairs, and James comfortably in his apartment on the lowest floor, he'd had some sense of what it might be like to live with a woman, to be married. Of course, Fenimore was so masculine in so many ways, fiercely independent, achingly but muscularly ambitious as a writer and poet in her own right, willing to break off even the most delightful conversation with James while sitting on the wide terrace of the Villa Bricieri near Bello Sguardo, watching a sunset in order to get back to her writing. But she was also a woman with a woman's mysteries. It had taken James months after Fenimore had left her leased home in Oxford before he realized that she'd come there, to the winter darkness of England, which depressed her so. She needed sunlight or her moods would plummet, to be near him while his sister Alice was dying. Near him. He'd taken her melancholic presence for granted while it was there for so many months. Only when she left Oxford in something like exasperation, if not outright anger, did he notice her by her absence. Fenimore could be cast in fiction as an amusing eccentric, made more amusing by her hearing problem that she would not acknowledge, and which made real conversation all the more difficult, especially in a salon or crowded public place. But James knew that she was no more eccentric than he, almost certainly less so. At least Fenimore, as far as he knew, was holding no secret at the core of her being. He had realized the previous year, just as Fenimore was leaving for Switzerland and then Italy again, while showing more asperity toward him than ever before, not only that she'd moved to Oxford for all that time to be near him to offer her support during the last months of his sister's life, but that, with Alice now gone, perhaps she had expected more attention from James. They'd often agreed to meet in European cities and even English towns, rigorously staying in separate hotels, but meeting for walks and dinners together and tours of art galleries or the occasional concert, which Fenimore enjoyed in spite of her hearing problem. Could she possibly have expected more than this? Could it be possible that she was in love with him? James had assiduously avoided being seen with her when mutual friends were about. They met in out-of-the-way towns, dined in hotels and restaurants which were nice enough, but in which James was close to certain he'd never find any of his friends. He was not ashamed or embarrassed by her, per se, since Constance Fenimore Woolson was one of the more interesting and sophisticated American writers he knew in Europe. He was simply terrified that a third party would think what Sister Alice had, on more than one occasion, written flippantly to William or someone else in his family, "Oh, Harry, he's off flirting with Fenimore Woolson on the continent." He allowed his dying sister to make such jokes. Having anyone else he knew do so, even, especially, his brother William, would devastate him. But he had lived with Fenimore in Bello Sguardo, lived with her after a fashion and by her terms, comfortable in their strangely similar and formal fellow bachelors devoted to their work way, and those weeks had changed him somehow. Mostly it had made Henry James realize how terribly, terribly lonely he was. A year ago, in May of 1892, just a month after his 49th birthday, James had visited Fenimore while she was packing to leave Oxford, and then gone straight home to write a passage in his unfolding story, The Wheel of Time. In his story, the 49-year-old main character Maurice Glanville had, in his 20s, rejected the plain-looking but secretly charming lady friend Fanny Knocker, only to meet her again on the continent decades later. Maurice's wife had died, leaving him with few memories of actual love and a rather plain-looking daughter. When 49-year-old Maurice meets Fanny again, now the widowed Mrs. Tregent, he sees to his astonishment that she has grown into that rare sort of beauty which reaches its apex only in middle age. And she has had a son, a strikingly handsome and dashing son just a little bit older than Maurice's rather plain and ordinary daughter. In the story, Fanny's son repeats Maurice's earlier betrayal of young Fanny Knocker by rejecting his daughter's hopes of marriage despite both his and Mrs. Tregent's efforts to make the match. Maurice's daughter was simply too plain for the handsome youth. But the real shock of the story occurs when Maurice learns that he, Maurice, had been the secret passion in Fanny Knocker Tregent's life for all these years, a love undeclared, unrealized, but central to her life. That day in May a year ago, after visiting the strangely irritated and rapidly departing Fenimore, James had gone straight home and written this scene where Maurice is meditating on this unknown passion, a discovery that makes his pleasure almost as great as his wonder. She had striven, she had accepted, she had conformed, but she had thought of him every day of her life. She had taken up duties and performed them. She had banished every weakness and practiced every virtue, but the still hidden flame had never been quenched. His image had interposed, his reality had remained, and she had never denied herself the sweetness of hoping that she would see him again and that she would know him. She had never raised a little finger for it, but fortune had answered her prayer. Women were capable of these mysteries of sentiment, these intensities of fidelity. And there were moments in which Maurice Glanville's heart beat strangely before a vision really so sublime. He seemed to understand now by what miracle Fanny Knocker had been beautified, the miracle of heroic docilities and accepted pangs and vanquished egotisms. It had never come in a night, but it had come by living for others. She was living for others still. It was impossible for him to see anything else at last than that she was living for him. The time of passion was over, but the time of service was long. He had written that scene, published that story, all while smugly and secretly, even to himself, knowing that he was writing about Constance Fenimore Woolson's long unstated passion for him. He hadn't fully admitted the power of that connection, even to himself, last year, but he saw it now. And he also saw, with his gorge rising in horror, that he might have been writing that passage about himself, about his unacknowledged, never recognized need, not for love, not for passion, never for desire, but still basic and compelling need for Fenimore to be in his life, to be in his life to relieve his terrible burden of loneliness, to encompass him with her almost masculine understanding and yet persistently feminine presence. Dear God, thought Henry James on this Saturday morning a week before his 50th birthday, I have to get out of here, away from here. He would go to Boston to leave Alice's ashes and the marble urn on her grave where Miss Loring had set to rest the majority of Alice's cremated remains. Then he would go home. Home to England. One thing was now certain. With Sherlock Holmes gone from his life, the question Holmes had raised as to whether he was real or a fictional character, thus making Henry James an adjunct fictional character if he were merely being used in a work of fiction as Holmes's Dr. Watson-like assistant, made to marvel at Holmes's powers of deduction, was moot. With Holmes gone, doing whatever he was doing, wherever he was doing it, Henry James had returned to being just a living, breathing human being, albeit a powerfully gifted and talented one. There was a rapid knock at his door. James said, "Enter," without thinking, and Clara Hay fairly danced into the room.
"You must see this, Harry. You simply must," she cried, as giddy as a girl.
She caught his left hand in both of hers and all but lifted him bodily up and out of his chair. She led the amazed author to the door.
"No need for your coat, Harry. It's as warm as a summer's day outside, and it's only a few steps. You simply must see this. It's too wonderful to miss."
"See what?" managed James as they hurried down the broad central staircase toward where Benson held the front door open for them.
"The flying Vernettis!"
The crowd had gathered on the green grass of Lafayette Square Park and were looking up at what Clara reminded him was the Camerons' huge house. James saw Lizzie Cameron near the front of the crowd, but not her husband Don, of course, he would be at work, shading her eyes with her hand so that she could see better. James noticed other high society neighbors, mostly matrons, of the Hayes and Adamses and Camerons neighborhood, gathered near the east side of the park, while more common folk, including some street workers still with their brooms, stood back a bit. Some of the society women, James saw young Helen Hay, were using opera glasses the better to see. But everyone was looking upward. Clara pointed. James shielded his own eyes and tried to find what they were all gawking at. There, along the highest roofline of the huge, steeply roofed house, a man and a boy were walking with exaggerated high steps, crossing the dangerous distance between one cluster of chimney pots to another. The man had a sort of quiver strapped to his back, and from that vessel rose various brushes and strangely apportioned brooms.
"Chimney sweeps?" said James,
astonished that Clara had dragged him out into the hot sunlight for mere chimney sweeps.
"Watch!" cried Clara Hay.
James saw that there might be some tension in watching the man and boy move carefully along that high, narrow roof beam, since they were almost 60 feet up and the Cameron's roof was far too steep to stop their fall if either one slipped. Suddenly, James and the crowd gasped as the boy did a forward cartwheel on the narrow ridge, and the man, letting the quiver dangle by its strap so the brushes would not fall, did a handstand behind the boy, his hands on the slippery slate slabs on either side of the apex. The two were odd-looking creatures. Both man and boy, he might have been 11 or 12, no older, were rail-thin and dressed in black sweeps clothing that seemed several sizes too small for each of them. That was a deliberate effect, James noticed, since the socks and shirts protruding from the cuffs were red and black striped for the skinny man and green and black striped for the boy. The strangeness was enhanced by the fact that the grown chimney sweep had orange hair spiked up into a column, rather like a Mohawk Indian's vertical queue, while the boy's spiky hair, stabbing out in all directions, had been dyed a bright Kendall green. The man's face had been painted white, a skull, and the eyes were lost to sight in black paint. The boy's face was painted all white, save for the narrowest strip of red on his thin lips. The effect, at least for James, was disturbing. Suddenly, the almost emaciated-looking boy took the quiver of brushes from the scarecrow man and crouched low as the skull man leaned forward over the boy, tumbling in a perfect somersault along the 3-inch-wide ridgeline, and then immediately got to his feet and bent over as the boy jumped onto his back. The crowd let out a gasp and low moan, and some in the front stepped into those behind them, as if seeking to get out of range for when the man and boy fell. James felt a sense of unreality fall over him like a cloak as he watched the red and black striped man, his long white fingers looking truly skeletal, remove the covers to the triple chimney at the end of the ridgeline. Fingers moving in a blur, working together, orange-haired man and green-haired boy used a loose bit of rope to tie those coverings tight at the base of the chimney. Then the skeletal man, his black shoes looked almost like ballet slippers, leaped straight into the air until his legs were far apart, the shoe slippers on opposite sides of the 4-foot-wide triple chimney. The crowd gasped again, like a single organism, James thought. He had gasped as well, although not out loud, when the boy simply threw himself into the air 60 feet above the ground.